Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can we learn about the diversity of the natural world by learning about the astonishingly different parts that living things have evolved for procreation? At the heart of most animal reproduction, of course, is the union of sperm and egg that results in the development of a new individual. But as my guest today will tell us, the sheer variety of adaptations that allow creatures to get together suggests how much we can learn about all aspects of life by learning about propagation. Menno Schildhausen is an evolutionary biologist, ecologist, and permanent research scientist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center at Leiden University in the Netherlands. His new book is called Nature's Nether Regions: What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. Menno, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Before we start, in case it's not entirely clear, I will state explicitly that we will be talking about sex in this hour. We're not intending to be vulgar about it, but you will hear references to genitalia and what it's for. So children listening with you, if they are not ready for talk of the birds and bees yet, you might want to direct their attention elsewhere. Okay, that said, I want to start with the thing, Menno, that took me really by surprise here, which is that there is far more variety in animal genitalia than would be apparent by looking at the rest of the animal.
Yeah, that's true. And we've known that for a long time already. And somehow that knowledge, the fact that many species that look very similar on the outside actually have very differently shaped genitalia, that knowledge has for a long time been sort of a best kept secret of taxonomists, people who use this information to distinguish species, to describe new species. And somehow it took a long time for evolutionary biologists to start being surprised about this and to start asking the questions why this would be so, which is something that these taxonomists weren't asking. They were just using them as very useful ways to separate species.
What accounts for why sex organs might change faster than other parts of us?
Well, the easy answer is that somehow evolution works faster and more strongly on these organs than on other organs, and one of the reasons is that the type of selection. I mean, evolution works by selection, but there are two different kinds of selection. There's natural selection, which is adaptation to the environment, whereby a species will change its coat color over time to be better camouflaged in a certain habitat, for example. But there's also sexual selection, which is any improvement that increases a male or a female's chance of reproducing. Unlike natural selection, there is no endpoint for sexual selection. With natural selection, you can imagine that once a species is perfectly adapted to the environment, that's it. That's the optimum, and it will stay there until the environment changes. But with sexual selection, you're constantly competing with other members of the same species. So there's always an improvement possible, and that creates a sort of self-generating force that makes evolution in things that are evolving by sexual selection, like the shape and function of penises and vaginas in this case, much faster than in other organs.
Why do most animals have to have sex to reproduce in the first place? You explain here why we wouldn't just stick with cloning ourselves.
Yeah, that's a very hard question. It's a question that is surprising in itself. I mean, we're so used to sex as a way of reproduction that we often don't stop to think why this way of reproducing has evolved, because it's much more complex, like you say, than simply dividing yourself, cloning yourself, which is what a lot of bacteria do and which plants also can do. If you make a cutting, you're basically reproducing, helping that plant reproduce by cloning. So it happened a long time ago, so it's very hard to really prove what is the benefit of sex, but there are two main theories for which there is quite a bit of support. One of it is that you can outpace your enemies in the form of parasites, viruses, and other pathogens, organisms that try to parasitize on you or in you by constantly generating new genetic variation. If you're cloning yourself, you're making an identical copy of yourself, and that's what bacteria do. But if there is some sort of virus that attacks this species, it will latch on to, or it will circumvent any defenses that this species has in all individuals, because they're all identical. Whereas if you have sex, you generate always a little bit of variation, because you're always mixing your genetic information with that of another partner. So even though some of your offspring may die from a disease, some other offspring may survive. So that's probably one of the reasons. The other reason has to do with repairing errors in DNA. Again, it has to do with genetic variation. There are mutations in the DNA, and those are unavoidable. They're chemical errors being made when DNA is copied, and those errors over generations accumulate. There's no way of getting rid of them, unless if you are cloning yourself, unless you do sexual reproduction, which means that you're always combining your DNA with that from another individual, so that some individuals will inherit errors from yourself, some will inherit errors from the partner that you're mating with, but some may inherit good DNA from yourself and from the partner, and those individuals will then not inherit any mistakes from in their DNA. So those are the two main theories about why sex evolved in the first place.
I love this book because it made me think of so many questions that hadn't even occurred to me before. The other one is, why are there male bodies and female bodies in the first place?
Yep, that's another thing that, again, to us seems so obvious, but it's not obvious at all. Even if you accept that sexual reproduction is, even though it's less efficient than cloning, has a number of benefits, and that's why it evolved, there's nothing in that explanation, the two explanations that I just gave you, that says that there need to be two different sexes. You could have sexual reproduction if everybody is the same and everybody can mate with everybody else. And in fact, there are some fungi and single-celled organisms which have that, where everybody can mate with everybody else. The reason that separate sexes have evolved probably has to do with the fact that in our cells we carry so-called organelles. Organelles are tiny organs inside a cell, inside little particles, which in fact are the remnants of bacteria that somewhere deep in the evolutionary past invaded our cells and which have lived within those cells ever since. Those organelles retain some form of independence. They divide themselves. For example, our mitochondria are an example of those organelles, which are little energy factories in our cells. And in plants, chloroplasts are also organelles, which also divide themselves. They have a little bit of DNA left. And that means that since they divide themselves, they will also be competing for space with the other chloroplasts in the same cell, for example. So if you have two cells that fuse, let's say if you have a situation where there are no separate sexes, you have only one sex, and sexual reproduction simply means fusing of two sex cells of that one sex that there is, then the organelles from both sex cells will start competing with each other. And they might actually evolve ways to damage the other organelles from the other cell to divide quicker or to make them die. So in a sense, the cell becomes a battlefield for competition between organelles, which is not good for the organism in whose cells all this happens. So presumably, one way to get around this problem is by evolving a system where you have two separate sexes in which only one carries those organelles, and in our case, that's the females, or at least that's what we call females. So an egg cell produces an egg cell contains organelles, but a sperm cell doesn't contain organelles. So the offspring, our children, carry organelles that are only inherited from the mother via the egg cell, and there's no opportunity for competition between those organelles.
And are the egg cells always much larger in nature than sperm cells?
Yes, in principle they are. And that's one of the explanations for the fact that sexual selection is usually usually consists of competition among males for access to those egg cells, which are usually fewer in number. They're produced in lower numbers and they contain much more nutrients. But there are some cases where sperm cells are also getting very, very big. There are some fruit flies, for example, where the sperm cells are almost the same size of an egg cell, and they have a huge tail, which is 2 centimeters long, so about 10 times as long as the fly itself, because these fruit flies are very small. But they're all, of course, the tail can be coiled up, so it doesn't need to be stretched out in the animal. But there are some cases like these flies where the sperm cells have evolved a relatively large size. But in animals like humans and our relatives, the sperm are really, really tiny. They're the smallest cells we produce.
Menno Schildhausen is my guest. He's an evolutionary biologist and author of Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Menno Schildhausen.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with evolutionary biologist Menno Schildhausen of Leiden University in the Netherlands. His new book is called Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. So, Menno, some animals put egg and sperm together sort of remotely, right? It doesn't happen inside anybody's body. It just happens, and everybody hopes for the best for the new little creatures that have been formed. Why is sex, it seems like, the preferred method in nature for so many animals?
You mean why doesn't everybody just release their eggs and sperm in the environment?
Why don't we all do it like
corals
fish?
Do?
Right, exactly.
In fact, many animals do. Of course, often in the water, that's a very efficient way to do it. And in fact, many plants on land do the same thing in spring, when you have all this pollen in the air, that's basically the same thing that's happening in the sea when fish or corals reproduce. But there's lots of animals which don't do that, which take more trouble to bring those sperm and eggs together with special organs, which we call genitalia, mostly on land, because sperm cells and egg cells too are very vulnerable. They dry out in no time in the air. So you need a way to get sperm and egg together without either being exposed to the open air. And genitalia are one way to do that. But even in the water, there are some animals which still use genitalia to copulate and to mate in the to us familiar way. For example, barnacles, which sit on rocks and often in the surf, where it's very hard to, even if you cast your eggs and sperm in the water, for them to meet each other and reattach to the same surface where the parents were living. So they also copulate. They also they have very long. Actually, the burrowing barnacle is the animal with the with for its body size, the longest penis in the world. It's about 10 times longer than the size of the barnacle itself. And they use this penis to sort of in a snake-like way probe around in the barnacle colony and find fertilizable other barnacles.
Yeah, I had never thought about that before I read the book. And there's a little illustration because they're kind of locked down, right? They can't go anywhere. Yep. So they have to have equipment that is suitable.
Exactly.
Tell us about different ways that animals have, male animals in particular, to make sure that whoever has been there before them, that they have the advantage.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the probably one of the reasons why there is so much diversity in male genitalia in animals. Namely, that they are sometimes not just used as a way to simply deposit sperm in a female, but also to outcompete other males who had encounters with this female before this particular male did. So, for example, damselflies are a famous example because they were one of the first animals in which this was discovered back in the 1970s. They have a sort of scoop at their penis, which they use to scoop out any sperm from a previous male out of the vagina of the female that they're mating with before they insert their own sperm. So if you've I think around wet areas you can see damselflies and dragonflies often mating. They fly around as a so-called mating wheel with the male grabbing onto the female and the female having her abdomen moved forward to meet the penis of the male, which is situated very much at the front of his lower body. And if you look carefully, you can see that while they're mating, they go through two phases, one where there's sort of an undulating movement going through this long, wispy body of the male, which is the phase during which all this scraping is going on. So he's actually cleaning out the vagina of the female. And only then, at the end, the abdomen takes up more convex shape, and that's when actual fertilization takes place. So the penis serves at least two functions in these animals, and this is something we see in a lot of other animals too. It was just discovered first in damselflies, and it's been studied a lot there, but it happens much more often.
Do female bodies have ways of being selective about the sperm cells that find their ways to the egg?
They do too, yes. And again, that's something that comes to a surprise to many, because we tend to think that once a female has allowed a male to mate with her, then she's going to be inseminated and fertilized, and this male has just as much chance of fathering her offspring as any other male. But it turns out that in many animals, even after mating, the female still has many ways of choosing among the various males that she's mated with. For example, there are many animals which have which store sperm from different males in different separate chambers. Snails, for example, they have little sperm pockets, and it's assumed, it's not certainly known, not known for certain, but it's assumed that those sperm pockets are used for storing sperm of separate partners. In one animal in which we do know that this is what happens is the dung fly, which is not a very glamorous animal, but it's very sophisticated in the way the females deal with the males that they mate with, because they have three different pockets in which they store sperm, one in the middle and two on the side, and the two on the side are used for less sexy males, and the one in the middle is the one in which they preferentially store sperm from the biggest and therefore most sexy males that they mate with. So they can actually control which storage place of sperm they use for fertilizing the eggs. So they can also decide, quote unquote, decide which of the males she's mated with is going to be the father of one particular offspring.
All right, so let's talk about female selectivity, right? I think we understand by looking at ourselves as humans why females tend to be more selective than males. Often in nature, females are looking for like these brighter displays or certain secondary sex characteristics, as you mentioned. But what good does it do, say, a cardinal to to find a male cardinal with the very brightest red feathers? I mean, how does that really help her?
Well, there are different possibilities. Sometimes the fact that a male is very brightly colored tells a female something about his health or his genetic quality, as you could call it. We know that many of these pigments that are used for coloration in birds and fish and insects, especially bright orange and bright red and black also, these pigments often play a role in the immune system. So the compounds which produce the color are also compounds that are often intermediates, compounds in this whole network of chemical interactions in the immune system. So the fact that a male can permit himself to waste some of those compounds in coloration means that he must have a good immune system, because it's good enough for him to waste some of that in coloration, in red and black coloration. So in those cases, a female probably chooses red males or brightly colored males because it tells her something about his immune system and the quality of his genes, which she can then, via his sperm, transmit to her offspring. But sometimes it seems to be that the females choose males simply based on something as frivolous as their being attractive, being striking. And there are many examples. There's a very good study which was done by a researcher called Nancy Burley with zebra finches, where she produced artificial ornaments on male finches. She colored feathers and stuck them as a little crest on their heads. So she gave them colored rings on their legs and little colored hats, anything that doesn't really occur in zebra finches. And it turns out that females still preferred males with those unnatural ornamentation, simply because they struck them as unusual. They noticed them because they looked different, and that may seem like a very stupid notion of the females to select a male finch for something as important as fathering your eggs, based on something as frivolous as them having a little red hat on their heads. But in nature, where these traits, of course, are inherited, if those traits are inherited by, of course, those hats were not inherited, but if they would do the same with a particular new red crest on males' heads, and select mates on the basis of that, then those red crests would be inherited by her offspring, and they would also be more, at least the sons would be more successful in finding females who would be willing to mate with them. So simply by the fact that these traits are noticed and are selected by females, that in itself is an advantage, because that will be transmitted to the offspring, and they will also become, at least the sons will also become, sexy.
So I greatly enjoyed the book, but it has put me off calamari forever.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about about the story that you have in the book?
Yeah, there's, calamari, so squid and other so-called cephalopods, octopuses, argonauts, etc. They have so-called spermatophores. So the males produce little sperm grenades. They're literally sperm grenades. They're little packages of sperm which can self-detonate. They don't detonate inside the male, but the male uses one of its arms to produce one of those spermatophores and either insert them onto or into the female. So again, they mate in a very unconventional way. And as soon as they hit the female, this little sperm grenade explodes, and the sperm find their way to the eggs of the female.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. That system works. These sperm grenades would fertilize only other squids, were it not for the fact that humans catch squids and sometimes only parboil them before eating them, in which case the sperm grenades are still functional. And this is what happens in Asia a lot. So regularly medical cases are reported where diners are stung in the mouth by these exploding sperm grenades because they've eaten a male squid which was not properly cooked, and those sperm grenades were still active. And these, then it turns out that these things can be, they really attach very very viciously because they have a little bit of cement and some abrasive material, and they can explode with quite a bit of force. So these are really painful lesions to the gums of these people who are eating these squid. And much of what we know about how these sperm grenades work is from those medical cases that keep being reported, in especially in Asia, where squid is often only partly cooked before it's eaten.
We're safe if it's deep fried?
It should be safe if it's deep fried, yes.
Menno Schildhausen is my guest. He's an evolutionary biologist at the Naturalist Biodiversity Center at Leiden University in the Netherlands, and author of the new book, Nature's Nether Region, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts tell us about evolution, biodiversity, and ourselves. We'll be back in 2 minutes to talk about nature's nether regions.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with evolutionary biologist, ecologist, and research scientist Menno Schildhausen. He's employed at the Naturalist Biodiversity Center at Leiden University, and he's author of the new book, Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd. Think. So, Menno, I live not too far from an in-town lake, and I like to go by there with my family sometimes, see the ducks swimming around. I had never, until I picked up your book, thought much about their sex lives.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think you're not the only one, Chris, who hasn't thought about their sex lives, although we do often observe that during mating season, ducks mating is not always very gentle. You do see what appears to be rape going on. Several males chasing a single female and cornering her somewhere in the pond. Maybe you've seen the same happening in your local pond or lake. And it seems as if the female really has no say in the matter. She is at the mercy of these two, three, or sometimes even more males who chase her. And it seems as if they will inseminate her and they will father her offspring, whether she likes it or not. But again, it turns out that, brutal as it may seem, in fact, the female still has the last word in this. A very nice study was done about 10 years ago by Patricia Brennan, who then was at Yale University, who showed that in fact the penis, ducks are one of the few birds which have penises. Most birds simply have cloacas, so just simple opening which the male and the female press together. But in ducks, there's an actual penis and an actual vagina. And in mallards, mallard ducks, which is the standard duck that you mostly see, it's a European duck, but it's also the duck that's bred and cultivated and eaten. There, the male has a very long corkscrew-shaped penis, which it more or less explosively inflates when it tries to mate forcefully with a female. And it turns out that, what Patricia Brennan found out, is that the females also have a cork or a coiled vagina, but this vagina is coiled in the opposite direction. Mm. So a coil, of course, can be right-handed and left-handed, clockwise or anti-clockwise, and turns out that the coiling direction of the vagina is the opposite direction from the one of the penis, which means that the female, simply by flexing her vaginal muscles, can block entry to the male very, very effectively. So even when she is being attended quote unquote, by multiple males who are mating with her, she can still, while all this is going on, select which males, if any, is going to successfully inseminate her.
Nature is remarkably clever.
Mm.
Talk about spiders. It seems like you could have written a whole book about spider sex.
Yes. Spiders are. They figure quite prominently in the book, which is partly because a lot of research has been done on spider sex, and that in itself, again, is partly to do with the fact that their genitals are easily visible, both in the females, but especially in the males, which is not the case for many other creepy crawlies where the genitalia are hidden away. Spiders, they have a rather roundabout way of using their genitals. Spider males, they produce sperm at the end of their abdomen, of their belly, which is more or less where you would expect the sperm to be produced. But then they don't have a regular penis, but they have two little boxing gloves which they carry on either side of their head, which they use to suck up their own sperm. So the male produces a very tiny web in which it deposits a little droplet of sperm, and then it backtracks a few paces and dips those boxing gloves into the sperm to suck it up, and then it goes in search for a female. In most cases, sometimes they do the sucking up while they're already copulating or courting a female. But often in other spiders, they load those pedipalps, as they're called, with sperm first, and then they go look for females. And it turns out that, again, these pedipalps, these boxing gloves, are very differently shaped between different species of spider. And again, this probably has evolved because the way it is structured allows for the male to carry out a sort of what we call copulatory courtship. So while he is mating with the female, he makes all kinds of prying movements with these complexly shaped boxing gloves, and only if he will often inseminate the female, no matter how much the female likes what he has done. But we notice that often the female then ejects the sperm if she's not satisfied with the way he has performed this copulatory courtship with his pedipalps.
Hmm. How much do we know about human sex? I mean, compared to what we've learned about animals, it would seem that we know absolutely everything there is to know about the way that humans reproduce.
Yes, that's what you would expect. I mean, it's the species that we know best. We've had centuries of research on the way our bodies are shaped and function.
Most people have tried it.
Yes, we know from first-hand experience what goes on. So you'd think we know a lot about human genitalia and how they work, but it turns out that it's actually we know very little for sure. There have been a few experiments have been carried out, for example, on the function of the female orgasm, which is there is some evidence which suggests that this may play a role in absorbing sperm of a male that is particularly preferred by a human female. But there's only one or two experiments have been carried out in the previous century on a very small number of females, and we really don't know for sure yet what the female orgasm is for.
Do you think the lack of research still has to do with, and I know the Netherlands is different culturally than the United States, but are we still somehow, do we feel shy or embarrassed about doing research on this sort of thing and getting funding for research on this sort of thing?
Yeah, there is that. Of course, there are some things that you can't do with humans that you can do with many experimental animals, especially mm-hmm. especially insects. So there are certain limitations as well. if you read the book, you may have noticed that some ways in which insects are being studied is by making them mate and then dumping a load of liquid nitrogen over them to freeze them in the act, and then dissecting them and finding out what goes where. You obviously can't do that with humans or even other mammals. So that there are some limitations, of course, to what we can do to find out what goes on. But I think you're right that there's also social and cultural and ethical limitations. I could imagine that there's one of the experiments that I describe in my book, which was done in the 1990s in the UK, where a pair of researchers got a whole bunch of students and colleagues to really donate their sperm to them, except that this was after sex. So they gave them condoms and they gave them questionnaires and let them donate sperm samples. And through this, they were able to figure out how much sperm is retained by women and how much is ejected after sex. I must say this is still, in my mind, one of the most courageous biological experiments that has been carried out in this field, because, well, I'm not sure if I would be brave enough to go up to my colleagues and my students and suggest to them, let alone suggest it to my superior, that I was going to do such an experiment. So I think there is some shame, some embarrassment, some taboos that you really need to overcome if you want to understand how our own sex works. But it's still something that I think hasn't been done enough yet.
Menno Schildhausen is an evolutionary biologist, ecologist, and permanent research scientist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center at Leiden University. His new book is called Nature's Nether Regions: What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. Menno, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you very much, Chris. It was my pleasure.
Thanks to all of you listening today. We really appreciate you being with us as we talk about everything there is to talk about here on The Think Show and throughout the day on KERA. Thank you.